Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And I'm going to be completely upfront before we start this podcast, Jem. I've had a couple of days of it. I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning a couple of days ago on Thursday. We're recording this on Saturday now. I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning, got a 4 o'clock ferry, drove all the way to Penzance, got to Penzance about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Went almost straight to the theatre, set up for a show, did a show, finished up that show about midnight, slept in my van for a couple of hours, got up the next morning, drove all the way from Penzance back to Portsmouth because I'm a fantastic tour schedule manager for myself. Halfway through that, my van decided to stop at the side of the road. I got to Portsmouth. I did another great show there. Then I had to get the midnight ferry back to the Isle of Wight, which means I got in about 2 o'clock this morning. And we're recording this, just so everyone knows, just before 9 o'clock. And what I'm saying, Jem, is don't expect...
That's 9 o'clock in the morning.
Don't expect coherency from me on this particular podcast. So with my little... you know, set up in place. And I ought to really actually make that advance warning in front of every podcast. Don't expect coherency from me ever. Jem, what are we actually talking about today?
We're talking about why do empires fail? Why do empires end? So it's such a big topic. You can pick anything you want.
I know this one. It's because of the Jedi and Luke Skywalker, and they just keep destroying Death Stars. Spoiler alert, by the way. They keep destroying Death Stars, and I'm sure there was some other stuff. I heard about this on Neon. So, Star Wars. Is that the right one, or are we...
Well, it's an empire, for sure. And, you know, I find it interesting. You know, perhaps there's the absolute classic book, Gibbons's book, The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. And that name has led to loads of books being called that, The Rise and Fall of the British Empire, The Rise and Fall, da-dee-da-da-da-da. And so it goes on. And it is interesting that nothing lasts forever. And it doesn't matter how powerful any empire in the past was, or indeed even how long standing. It's interesting, some empires lasted just one lifetime, that's it, and others lasted for centuries. So it doesn't matter how well established they are, how powerful they are, how innovative they always fail. And I find that interesting.
I agree, and I mean, there's part of that you said that nothing lasts forever, and you know, if we look at it in that sense, then obviously every empire, but we're looking for a sort of a specific thing to do with empires. But in order to address this question, we kind of have to come to some sort of agreement of what an empire is. Because as you say, sometimes an empire lasts a lifetime, sometimes it can last many hundreds of years. But, I mean, there's that wonderful line in Blackadder where you know, at the start of World War One, the British Empire covered 2/3 of the globe, and the German Empire was a small sausage factory just outside of Stuttgart. You know, it's that sort of... At what point does it tip over from being a country to an empire? I mean, when we're looking at pre-war Germany obviously was originally divided up into a series of states. You had, sort of Prussia. And as it started to expand and join up, it became Germany. But Germany is a country. It's not an empire of all these smaller countries. So what is the definition of empire as opposed to country or state?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because people forget that Germany did have overseas colonies. Germany and America, both of them came very late to the empire building game. You know, the first ones from Europe that really did a big deal was actually Spain. Britain and France ended up becoming better at it than Spain and Portugal. So, I take your point, but actually, you know, you had fighting in modern day Uganda in World War One because at that time Uganda was a German territory, and so at the end of World War One, their overseas territories were basically split between Britain and France, and we forget that Germany did genuinely have overseas colonies in other countries. So I think you're right. Empires aren't defined specifically by land, and empires aren't defined specifically by time. But I think as soon as you start running alien people, not your neighbours who might be speaking the same language as you and same religion as you, but as soon as you start ruling people who don't have the same core roots of society, culture, history, religion, etc., then I think you can safely say it's an empire. And going back to a much earlier empire, Alexander the Great, he's an example of one that lasted, it basically lasted his lifetime. But there can be no doubt that as he was dying at the age of 33 in ancient Babylon, ancient Babylon, for starters, is a long way away from ancient Macedonia, which is now modern-day northern Greece. But, he ruled an empire that included Egypt and Persia and the Middle East and Afghanistan. And, yes, clearly that's an empire, but it lasted a remarkably short amount of time, because it was him who was gluing it all together, and he was dead at 33, as I've just said.
And I think it's part of the definition of an empire, then, that sort of the elements of the empire have to, in a way, also be separate from the main. Obviously, if, you take over another country, it's adjoined to you, you take it over, that is in, and next it really becomes part of your country. If you leave sort of, do you have to leave some sort of other governing body in charge that you are then overseeing and commanding over? Is there some element of that that makes it an empire?
Now, that's also a really interesting point, because you get something like the Mongol Empire in the 13th century, and it's left very little impact. I mean, it's left a huge swathe of destruction. For example, we tend to think of the modern-day country of Iraq as really barren and deserty, but actually prior to the Mongols, it was far more lush. It had far more agricultural area, but that was annihilated by the Mongols 700 years ago, and they still haven't recovered. That shows you how complete their destruction of the canal and waterways had been in central Iraq. Anyway, but the point about the Mongols is that undeniably they ruled the largest land-based empire in history, the second largest overall in history, second only to the British Empire. But they didn't set up a load of... Everybody didn't have to learn Mongolian. They didn't put up big statues to Genghis Khan everywhere. So actually, it evaporated very quickly once this sort of central power of force and fear left. But then you get something like the British. And the British Empire is a really weird one, because when you look at places like Versailles, or you look at something like the Kremlin, you sit there and think, wow, how rich and powerful were these empires to have these amazing palaces? Why don't we have those in Britain? And it's like, Buckingham Palace, my mother described it as this, and I can't get it out of my head. Buckingham Palace is perhaps the biggest and most important palace of the royal family in Britain, but it does look like the rear of a more impressive palace somewhere else. So but the weird thing is, we had the biggest empire. We had more money than anyone else. So, if we wanted to build the Taj Mahal next to the Kremlin and slap Versailles on top of it, we had the money to do that. But what's interesting is the British Empire, by the time we were in our stride, it was a democracy in a sort of Victorian sense of the term democracy. So we didn't build huge cathedrals and palaces. What we tended to do was build gigantic structures like things like St. Pancras Station in London. They were spending their money on things like suspension bridges and a railway network across India, which is still used to this day. We can absolutely talk about the negative impact of the British Empire, but one of the nice things was they didn't waste their money on loads and loads of palaces. They actually spent it on logistics and actual useful engineering feats, that's why there's no British Versailles, but yay, we have decent sewers in London.
Okay, so trying to sort of move us on to the topic that we started with, which is why empires always collapse. And I think this comes down to the very nature of empire itself, because I am going to use a Star Wars analogy here, because that for some reason is the empire that's on my head at the moment. If you are trying to control an empire and you've got different things all over the place, and when we look at Star Wars, you've got loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of different planets, and the trouble with that is, how do you keep control, how do you maintain authority on every one of those different planets? We know throughout history how many countries and areas like that have had revolutions of their own. And they happen independent of each other. They very often also trigger revolution somewhere else. There's no question that there is a certain extent to which the English Civil War, the French Revolution, and in particular the French Revolution and the American Revolution, all tie-in together. They're all encouraging each other in that sort of way. That they're all, once a revolution starts, you look at what's happened in other places. And the thing with an empire is, it's not the same as having a country with a single governing body. And so what we see in, you know, when you watch Star Wars, what you see is different planets. It always deals with this planet, that planet. Oh, there's a battle going on Hoth. There's a battle going on the Boo for control of this planet or this planet or this planet. You can't do something in one go that says, right, we're going to, in a single move, put down every revolution in every single area of our empire, because every one of their revolutions is about a different issue. And that's really sort of the trouble, I think, that a lot of empires have. You end up fighting so many different problems as you go around. That's part one of what I think the issue is the issue of control from the inside.
Okay.
Part two, I'm going to lay down, is the problem, and here I'm going to go for a slightly different analogy. I'm on analogies this morning. A block of ice, okay. If you have quite a small block of ice with very small sides, as we all learnt in science, it starts to melt quite slowly because it has a very small surface area. If you take that block of ice and you spread it out and freeze a very, very thin level of water, because of that large surface area, it will melt quite quickly. If you have your entire army and everyone contained in a small country, you have a border that is easily controlled, easily defined, quite clear. Once you start spreading out your empire, every time you take over another country, your border expands a lot. Also, the number of countries touching the edge of your empire expands a lot. So not only do you have a lot more different issues of potential revolution within the empire, your empire is now touching up against a lot more different countries that might want to cause trouble from the outside. And I just think every empire is going to hit a critical mass where they're trying to control too many different people, and there are too many different people on the outside looking in, waiting for that first sign of weakness. And between those two things, I think that is probably why every empire will eventually just fold and collapse.
I would like our listeners to pause for a moment and think about how a very tired Greg has managed to pull together a bit of pop culture, imperial history, science, talking about surface areas, and coming up with his two-pronged, the Chapman two-pronged theory of empire decline. I mean, I applaud you, sir. There you go. That's very, very impressive. I don't disagree with anything that you've just said there. What I would sort of say to build on the Chapman hypothesis is that you can either look at old or new. And I think that your second point about the expanding borders is what happened to old empires. What's interesting with the Roman Empire is when you get to somebody like Hadrian, he recognizes that the empire's kind of hit its maximum surface area that it can deal with. And it's interesting that it's actually Hadrian who actually takes a step back. That I've forgotten all the name of these wars. It's all in the Romans and 100 Facts. But the point is that they were fighting in what is now sort of the modern day, sort of like Croatia, that sort of area, Croatia, Romania. And they actually pulled back. And even though they'd won it, they just realized it was too much hassle. And it's the same thing with Scotland. They did push past Hadrian's Wall, but it just wasn't worth the effort. So let's pull back a bit and we can spend less money running areas that are richer and less disruptive.
I'd just like to interrupt you for a second there, Jim, because I don't want you to get any hate mail or anything. Jim was saying that the Romans didn't think that Scotland was worth it. Okay, just because that wasn't
correct.
Jim's opinion.
Yes, but although the Scots would say, we made it not worth their while because we're such great fighters. It's like, look, if the Roman legions really, really wanted to have conquered Scotland, they could have. You know, if you start looking at the power of the Roman Empire, there was no doubt about it. But was it worth it? It wasn't particularly rich agricultural land. It wasn't full of gold or anything like that. It was quite cold. You know, it wasn't a lot. It wasn't worth the effort from the point of view of empire building. But yes, you're quite right. That is Roman imperial point of view, not not mine. But the so if you like, if you're dealing with horse and carts, there's only so far you can stretch your messenger network and things like that. The Mongols actually had their version of the Pony Express, basically all these stations all across the empire which had fresh horses, so people could gallop hard for like 10 miles, get to the next stop, and then pick up a fresh horse and gallop hard for the next 10 miles. So you could, that was the fastest you could possibly spread a message before we have the era of telecoms. But going back to your first point, I think that's empires from like 1800 onwards, or actually the 1700s onwards, where we've suddenly got this actually quite new idea of nationality. You know, if you go back to the year, let's say 1100 AD in Britain, you wouldn't say I'm an Englishman. You would say I'm a Londoner or I'm from Yorkshire, but you wouldn't think about the country because it was too big an idea. But then we come to the concept of, oh, everybody who speaks the same language in roughly the same area, we're the same country. And nationalism is the cancer to empires, because suddenly I don't want to be ruled by you guys way over there. I want to be ruled by local people who understand local customs and local language. And that's exactly what happened to the British Empire, and that's exactly what happened to the Ottoman Empire, because suddenly you've got all these countries that have less in common with each other than the glue that holds them all together.
And I think what we're moving worrying close to there is a discussion on Brexit. So let's veer away from that.
I didn't think we were going there, but okay, if you think we are, I was not going to talk about Brexit.
Just where you were saying about that whole idea of local rule, and as you say, that is something that's incredibly recent. The idea that we should be saying, you know, and you see these posts, you know, about we're Britain, let's make Britain great again, and, you know, all of this sort of, and, you know, this whole reference to Great Britain as if Great Britain doesn't just mean Big Britain as opposed to Brittany. But the trouble that kind of underlies the first part of what you said of that's a fairly modern problem is I don't think it applies. You don't have to go up to the level of a country to have the revolutions be a problem. And in a way, if you're dealing with countries, it actually reduces in some ways the problem of revolution. Because if we go right back to the Romans, obviously one of the most, or a couple of the most famous revolutions that the Romans faced were Boudica and the Iceni tribe rising up in Britain in around, I think, around 70 AD. And
you do have to be careful, though. I'm sorry, I'm just going to interrupt for a second. Nobody really calls it a revolution. It's a rebellion. It's an uprising. But revolution implies a slightly different politics going on, which just didn't exist at the time of Boudica. But you're quite right. She certainly didn't like the Romans.
No, and she wanted to get rid of Roman rule. And, I would make the argument that the suggestion of tucking out the current ruling system and replacing it with your own is a form of revolution. But we'll leave that one to one side because my brain's not good. We'll do that another episode. We'll argue about what a revolution is when my brain's functioning. Other famous, we'll call it an uprising. Another famous uprising, which really is an uprising, this one, is, of course, led by Spartacus within Italy itself, right near the heart of the Roman Empire. And the thing about this is, if you were dealing on a countrywide scale, you know, if you were dealing with Britain, you can keep Britain under control in that way. However, if you're then dealing with just, you know, a part of Britain, a part of Rome, a part of this area, a part of that area, then it's much harder to keep under control.
Greg, and actually, I've heard the analogy that sometimes fighting against these uprisings, modern day we use the term insurgency, is a bit like being pecked to death by pigeons or trying to stamp on jellyfish, in the sense that no one is actually fatal, but if enough of them happen, you're so spread thin in terms of your resources, it can cause a real problem. And it would be my argument about the sort of fall of empires is that I don't think moving forwards we're ever going to see empire building in the current state of humanity ever again. And I say that for a couple of reasons. First of all, nuclear weapons, the really big players have them, and if they ever felt that they were going to be wiped out by another big player, they would launch them and that would be the end of everything. Slightly grim, I know. But more importantly, the idea of there's been this solidified national barriers, boundaries, I should say, and borders. And on top of that, you know, if you're doing an uprising like Boudicca, she vastly outnumbered a Roman legion. But the Roman legion had the equipment and the training, and they just butchered them in the final battle. So it shows you that they just had an unhealthy advantage in terms of technology and people. Whereas today, sadly, again, we know, you know, getting access to guns or getting access to explosives is relatively easy, and you can cause a huge amount of trouble if you feel strongly enough that your government is not working, or indeed if there's an invading force. So the rules really have changed in terms of technology and ideology since the time of empire. Really, it was World War II that marks the end of kind of empire building. That's sort of my heavy bit, but I would absolutely agree that I think fundamentally when it comes down to why do these empires fail, more than anything else, it's about resource. You're hoping that the lands make you money rather than you're spending endless amounts of money trying to keep them in order.
I think that's true. And the other side, along with the technology, of course, is the sheer quantity of people we're discussing here, because I've just done a quick search to try and find out some relative populations. We've got research live on air as well. The Roman Empire in the year 25 BC consisted of about 57 million people. Now, compare that just with Britain today. Britain's population in 2016 was nearly 66 million people. Now, trying to administer an empire of, you know, 56 million people, that is difficult. Every single one of those people has their own ideas. And we only have to look at basic politics. Now we're running democracies as well. Basic politics in Britain. Try and put yourself in the position of somebody that just wants to be elected with one policy. Just come and try and think of one policy that you could come up with that would please even the majority of people in any one country. That's you know, you've got to straight away, just to get a majority just tipped over the edge, you've got to please, you know, sort of 33 million people. You've got to come up with something that's going to unite that many people. If you're then trying to govern an empire that gets any bigger than a country, well, I think we're on 7 billion odd people in the world today. Once you start getting to empire building, just a sheer quantity of people that you're then trying to control, that you're trying to keep happy enough to keep going without leading to uprisings and things, I think just a sheer quantity of people added to the rise in technology is really why we're going to just the whole idea of empire gets harder and harder and harder to see maintained.
Look, do you know what? I think I know this is going to mean it's slightly short here, folks, but come on. Greg's done science. He's done research. He's done numbers. You know, this is as good as it gets, people. I'm suitably impressed.
Are you telling me that you're telling me we should only record when I'm completely drained?
Well, it's been, from my point of view, it's been most surreal. I would not know that you're that tired, to be honest. Well done, sir. Very well done. So look, as a reward, I'm going to let you start off with your plugs.
Okay, well, I'm actually going to plug a charity today. As some of you may have seen, I can't even remember if I've mentioned it on the podcast yet, but I have set up recently a new set of shows called Curios Aquatica. That's C-U-R-I-O-S Aquatica. This is actually my first attempt to drag my fiance Flick into performing properly alongside me. We're doing these shows together. But as part of Curios Aquatica's work, which is all about conservation and saving the sea from all the pollution and overfishing and hunting that goes on, we are raising money for charities. And the first charity we're raising money for is the Marine Conservation Society UK. And if you go to curiosaquatica.com And on the top there, there's a fundraising link. If you click on that, and if anyone just wants to give, go through our Just Giving page, give £10, £5, anything at all to help out that charity. It helps that charity help our seas. It also very, very selfishly helps me and Flick to help show that QRS Aquatica is doing some good as well. So if you're in the mood, head over there. And Jim, what have you got to plug this week?
Oh, okay. I'm going to do collectively. Guys, I've written a whole bunch of books. I've had seven history books published. My very first book was another history book that was self-published, and I've also got a novel, historical novel, that was self-published. That's a total of 9 books. If you like history, if you like this podcast, come on, I'm sure you can buy one of them. Just type Jem Deducu into Amazon, or indeed go onto the Condensed Histories website, and there's a whole page of them there. Be it Forgotten History, which is a collection of fun little stories, or I've mentioned the Romans and 100 Facts, or my most recent one, which is The Sultans, a history about the Ottoman Empire from beginning to end. You get 600 years for the price of one book on that one. That's pretty good value. So yes, check out one of my books, please.
And that is all from us this week. Obviously, our general plug for this podcast as well. Please let somebody else know about the Condensed History Gems podcast. Get them to listen to an episode. Also, don't forget, if you haven't already done so, please head over to iTunes or wherever you're listening to this and just take a minute to leave us a little review, leave us a little 5-star rating. That really does help boost our listenership. Also, let me just say hello to any new listeners that come over recently. I know that some people have said they started listening after listening to Tales from the Road. I also know that Jem's other podcast, Neon, pushed itself right up towards the top of the charts on iTunes recently. So we've got a whole load of new listeners, and I'm sure there's some crossover coming and checking out this podcast as well. So hello and welcome to all of our new listeners. You found me apparently on better form than I was expecting today. Thank you very much, as always, to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducu.
And to my wonderful and tired co-host, Greg Chapman.
And we will speak to you next week when I will be awake and apparently slightly less competent. So thank you very much for listening. For now, goodbye and take care.